Hey listeners, just jumping in quickly before the podcast to notify you about the Bodytrack Academy educational webinars that we have available via Eventbrite. We cover a variety of topics ranging from oncology, musculoskeletal rehab, neurological rehab, mental health, performance, and much more, all of which you can access 24/7. That means you can purchase the webinar and watch it at any time that suits you. You can claim our webinars as PD points via SS self-assessment tool, and as a valued listener of the podcast, you're entitled to $10 off any of our webinars, but do hurry because the code is only available to the first 10 purchases. Just use the code FIRST10. So head on over to Eventbrite and browse our webinars. The link is in the show notes and on the Bodytrack Academy Facebook page. I'd like to begin this podcast by acknowledging the Yagara and the Turrbal people as the traditional custodians of Meanjin, the lands on which our podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Welcome to the Bodytrack Academy podcast, created by EPs for EPs. The podcast will take you on an in-depth understanding of everything an EP is faced with on a day-to-day basis, including clinical, personal, and business practices, to ensure you become the best practitioner possible. If you enjoy the podcast, make sure you like, share, follow us on whatever streaming service you use to ensure the message spreads and you are notified of any new podcasts or educational resources available to you. Furthermore, if you're not already part of our online academy, head over to Facebook and join the Bodytrack Academy. Happy listening.
Okay. Welcome back, listeners. My name's Gage. I'm one of the EPs here at Bodytrack, and today we have a very special guest, Caitlin from Milton Physio, just down the road. She's part of a physio team that we work quite closely with and share a lot of clients to get good outcomes. So I'll let Caitlin introduce herself, and just want to let us know a little bit about your experience in the field.
Thanks, Gage, and thank you so much for having me on. I've been a physio for over 15 years now. I'm dual master's qualified, so I have a master's in sports and exercise physiotherapy and musculoskeletal physiotherapy, and I'm one of four registrars on the Australian College of Physiotherapists Specialisation Training Program, which is a 2.5-year training program to be recognised as an expert level physiotherapist. So life's a little bit busy at the moment. My career started in the army. I did 11 years as a uniformed physiotherapist in the Australian Defence Force, including a couple of tours over in Afghanistan as well, and then decided it was time to come and try something different and fell in love with private practice. So it's been an absolutely amazing career today, and I'm excited to hear and see what the future has as well.
Lovely. Obviously, being a musculoskeletal physiotherapist, is there any particular area of the body, any particular type of presentation that you see the most of or enjoy seeing the most of?
I love treating anything that comes through the door, really, but probably one of the biggest ones we see a lot of, which is what we're going to talk about today, is
perfect segue.
Perfect segue to roll into.
Lovely. So today I'm going to talk about knee arthritis. It's probably not the most exciting topic, I think, especially maybe as new grads as we hear it, but talking to Caitlin and talking to other staff members, I think that knee OA is something that we sort of push to the side a little bit when we're treating it. It's something that we think maybe is not more important than it is. It's something that we think we might know a little bit more about that we don't. But what we wanted to talk about today was the role of an EP, the role of a physio in getting the best outcomes for knee OA, and shedding a bit of light on some assessments, some progressions, and some realistic timeframes of what we should see. So I know Caitlin's got some good notes here, but just at a whole, knee arthritis, it's extremely prevalent. I think you've got some numbers. I looked at some numbers, but go for it. Hit us with some numbers.
So when we had a look at a study that was conducted and published in 2020, there was actually 653 million people over the age of 40 that had knee osteoarthritis. So that's a lot. And 73% of those had knee osteoarthritis were greater than 55 years old, and 60% were females. So we do know that we can see it a lot more in females, and that's actually one of the risk factors that's associated with potentially getting knee osteoarthritis as well. But it's also quite common in the younger population as
well.
Yeah,
so, I see that.
Yeah, in that study, about 16% of people over the age of 15 had identified knee osteoarthritis as well. So it really goes to show it can come across the age spectrum. So it's something we need to look out for and have in our back, the background of our minds as a potential diagnosis.
Yeah, definitely. I think as EPs, like, we don't diagnose. And I think if we're seeing someone over the age of 15, arthritis is probably not what we associate with. But yeah, like you said, very prevalent. I think when we get a referral come in, whether it be from the doctor or someone else, there's a very high chance that knee OA is either the reason for the referral or it's a comorbidity that we need to keep in mind. So first question I have for you, Caitlin, was if you're having a client with knee OA come to you, what's sort of your overarching assessments and treatment that you do as a physiotherapist?
So as a physiotherapist, one of the key things is we want to understand the individual. So like you mentioned before, knee osteoarthritis can be a diagnosis or it can be a comorbidity of the individual that's coming in. So as part of the physio and getting the detailed history, we're really understanding, well, what are the potential contributing factors? Has this individual had surgery before? Has there been trauma to the knee before? Have they got a family history or underlying conditions that may predispose someone to getting osteoarthritis? Then following from that, as part of our assessment, we're having a look at some key factors to actually diagnose someone with osteoarthritis. Now, we recognise that we don't need to send someone for imaging to confirm that they have osteoarthritis. If they've actually got persistent knee pain, if they've got limited morning stiffness, so less than about 30 minutes of a morning, they've got reduced reported function, so what they're finding they cannot do that they used to be able to do, plus crepitus, so the noises that our knees make, restricted range of movement and bony enlargement. If someone has all of those six features, then with 99% accuracy, we can diagnose them with knee osteoarthritis. So that's really what we're having a look at, but that then fits one component of our examination. We then need to understand, well, how is this limiting you? What's your range of movement like? Are you limited into flexion? Are you limited into extension? What's your overall strength like, specifically with your quads and with your glutes, which is a really important feature, because we know there's a lot of evidence around there. If we keep your quads nice and strong, or if we keep your glutes nice and strong, then we're actually improving your overall quality of life, but also your functional capacity as well. So they're elements that we're having a look at as well. Not to forget, we're also having a look at the ankle. We're also having a look at the hip. We're having a look at all the other movement patterns that are coming into play from there. So they're really big key features. We'll also consider balance because we know if we've got reduced function, we've got reduced movement, we can actually increase falls risk as well. So they all fit into the individual when they're coming in and what we're having a look at. And then from there we identify, well, what key features do we need to work on, but also what does the individual want? Because a lot of individuals are really keen to go and work with EPs. They want to know, well, what can I do? How can I get stronger? How can I reduce the likelihood of this progressing? What do I need to do to avoid a knee replacement? So they're all different things that we incorporate into our sessions.
Yeah, excellent. That's great. And I think building on that last point that you say of what do they need to do, that's something that, like, here at BodyTrack, we definitely take on board, and I personally as an EP like to take on board. And it could be someone, okay, I want to get on and off the floor without pain. And the way that I'll take that is, okay, this client basically needs to be able to do a split squat down to the ground, and will need 90 degrees under load. And I usually will use that as like my end goal. So we're normally going to start with something like some quad sets or leg extensions, but I'll usually paint a path of, okay, what can this client do now? Can they only do some seated leg extensions? What are the progressions to get them to a split squat, essentially? Building on that, what are some specific strength assessments that you would do for the quads and the glutes when looking at a client for their initial assessment?
So for their initial assessment, we're having a look at what their knee extension is in sitting, and we might have a look at various ranges depending on what their range of movement is actually like. We'll have a look at their something like as simple as a bridge. Can they do a single leg bridge? because we know how much that challenges our posterior chain and also incorporates a little bit of control from a glute med as well.
Yeah.
We might choose to then, if they're functional, have a look at a squat. Mm-hmm. We might even have a look at a single leg squat, incorporating a bit more into that from a glutes function. And something we'll also have a look at is an active straight leg raise. So what are they like actually lifting their leg up, and can they do it under sustained force? Because something as simple as moving around in the bed, getting in and out of the car, that's something that we need to be able to do. So we can then try and make it a bit more functional for them. But often when we want to look at some specific measurables, if we've got a lad in clinic, awesome, we can put them on there and get something we can measure. Otherwise, we'll look at handheld dynamometry,
which
will give us those figures. But often what I'll do is refer to you guys going, okay, can you guys do the measurements for me and send them my way?
Yeah, yeah. In terms of like the handheld dynamometry, or we use the Vald now, which is really great, handheld force dynamometer, normative data doesn't really exist. So what would you recommend? Numbers wise, are we looking at the affected side versus the non-affected side? Is there any other like use of templates or normative data that you use to guide what specific numbers we should be looking for?
So you can find some specific numbers, but not specific for knee osteoarthritis. Yeah. So you can measure it against a general population with regards to age. But more often than not, if you're having a look at the unaffected side or the side, if it's got bilateral knee osteoarthritis, the side that gives them the most function or they feel most comfortable with, you're aiming for matching that from that aspect of it. And then obviously you're improving with the program.
Yeah, excellent.
As well.
I was also going to ask as well, looking, obviously we want to look above and below the area. Something that I do in my practice at the moment is looking at sort of range of motion through the hips, through the hamstrings, glutes, and specifically the ankle. Because we know, especially with knee OA, sometimes we get like a maladaptive gait, or someone's going to move a little bit differently, or they're working something in a different area. Do you have a little bit of a battery of some range of motion exercises that you move through?
Not really.
Yeah.
It's really individual to the person that's coming in. So always screening hip and ankle for a range of movement, and it may simply be functional.
Yep.
For them. So what's their squat pattern like? What are they like going up and down stairs? How do they go from doing a sit to stand from a normal chair is there? And we can get really specific with that, having a look for what's the knee wall like. However, being aware of how much that actually loads the front of the knee. So they may end up with more feeling more anterior knee pain, prior to actually feeling limitations with that ankle range of movement with it. So I guess from other aspects I'd have a look at is what is their calf strength like?
Yep.
Because we know that's important from a strengthening perspective. We would have a look at what the hip range of movement is like. Again, can do it actively in sitting or passively, just have a look what it's like and understand, well, is there some other impairments that are at play here? Do they have FAI?
Yep.
Which is that actually contributing to why they have knee osteoarthritis because of how differently they're choosing to load? So multiple factors at play, but I don't sort of have one suite of a battery test.
Of course.
It's really quite individualized.
In terms of knee extension, so we know that knee extension is something that usually can reduce as the condition progresses. Mm-hmm. Is there any sort of degree or assessment where you'd say, okay, this is probably not good enough, we'd be looking at some sort of other intervention of leg extension where it impacts their gait or is causing pain in other areas?
So I guess one aspect that comes to it is a lot of people can function with a knee flexion deformity, so hip flexion deformity. And I guess it gets to the point, well, when does it actually limit their function? And I think of a patient that I've had, she's now 18 months post-total knee replacement. She'd been walking on a 15-degree fixed flexion deformity for 2 years.
Wow, that's so impressive.
But it was completely functional for her. She didn't think anything less of it. And then it got to the point where she's like, I can actually no longer function with this. So there's no hard and fast rule around that. When we consider the type of interventions, they tend not to do arthroscopies anymore.
Yes.
They will look at going, do we need to do a total knee replacement or a unicompartment replacement as well.
Yeah.
with it. So it then comes down to the function of the individual. So if they're finding that function is impeding, subsequent strength is impeding, they're no longer doing the ADLs or the activities that they used to, that's when we then consider, is it time for a surgical intervention?
Yeah.
Which, you know, 30 years ago, it would have been go for as long as you can before it stops getting, you know, really influencing life. Whereas nowadays we go, well, you're actually going to get probably the rest of your life out of your total knee replacement.
Yeah.
So rather than waiting until they've got significant reduced range of movement, significant loss of global strengthening, we go, this is really getting to the point where let's have a look now and potentially get a replacement sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
But if someone's still getting full extension, they only get the occasional episode of pain or aggravation associated with the knee osteoarthritis, or it's like, oh, just every now and again after I've had a big day looking after the grandkids, it might be sore for a couple of hours. That's where we think about, well, how can we actually change when you're getting up and down off the floor with the grandkids? How can we introduce different interventions that may help you feel a bit more comfortable? Do you actually need a knee guard on those days? So that's how we tend to have a look at the conversation.
Yeah.
And it's not just loss of knee extension. It can also be varus or valgus.
Yes.
Angle of change that can then indicate whether we need surgery or not.
Yeah, of course. I think that's a good point to mention of the sort of education around, okay, what are they doing and what's normal? What's a normal amount of pain? I know sort of we've been taught through our practice with the red light, green light, and sort of accepting anything under a 5 out of 10 pain that is only painful whilst you're doing the exercise and ceases afterwards. Is that something that you follow along the lines of as well?
We have a look at a couple of other things that come into play. So it's not just, well, what's your pain level out of 10? It's what's the subsequent associated? Are you getting any swelling in the joint? Do you then get any pain overnight, or does it limit your ability to get comfortable overnight and get some sleep through there? When it comes from a pain perspective as well, I guess another aspect of is, where is it painful? Are you feeling painful because you're actually using some muscles you haven't used in a while? So it's really about that education to the patient about understanding what their interpretation of pain is, where they feel their pain, and whether they actually associate themselves with pain is strange.
Yep.
Whereas it's actually, to some people, oh no, I can't do that. It's painful. I can't have any pain at all. Whereas others, it's around the conversation. They're like, okay, I can understand that this is okay for me and I'm feeling an element of discomfort rather than I want to get up and walk away because this is too sore for me.
Yeah.
So it's about, you know, everyone has their own little principles that they choose to use with regards to pain and what system will be a limiting factor. So with you guys with the red and the green light, whereas for some individuals it's sometimes a little bit more specific with that, where it might be, okay, if this is more pain that you get than when you go for your walks that you've been doing daily, let's not nudge into that too much through then.
No, I think that's a really good point. And like building on that, something sort of in EP when I went through is sort of like that support and education around the like knee OA and like you were saying, for okay, when is it the best decision to get a replacement or take that next step, which is not our call, and it sometimes leaves us in that gray area of okay, like we're doing really good, we might be improving this or this isn't improving, what's a normal amount of flare-ups. What would your sort of tips be on supporting someone in that position that might be on the fence? What sort of conversations would you have with them?
Hey, thanks for taking the time to listen to our podcast. We hope you're learning a lot in this particular episode. Just a shout out to our sponsor, HGG Performance, which provide very high quality, innovative gym equipment and custom fit outs to enable you to pivot your potential and smash your performance and rehab goals. They are world renowned for their innovative creations in the gym accessory space, including the best-selling ISO Tib LT, Tib Bar, Wrist Axe, and Nordic Bar. And I got to say, we're using some of these equipment in our clinic and finding some great results. Used by professional sports teams, athletes, and coaches worldwide, as well as the military, health practitioners, and apparently even Joe Rogan uses their gear. HGG is a proudly Aussie-owned company that makes all their gym equipment at their Gold Coast HQ. And our partnership with them, we are stoked to offer you 10% discount on any product with the code BODYTRACK10. so you can experience what all the hype is about yourself. So jump over to their website, go to the checkout, punch in the code of BodyTrack10 to get 10% off on any of their great innovative gym equipment and start using today. Thanks very much.
Definitely been having a conversations around, well, what are they finding is limiting? So how yeah. is their knee limiting their activities in life? How often are they getting their flare-ups? Are their flare-ups something that's easily manageable, or are their flare-ups something that knocks them out for a whole week where they don't want to then go for a walk, or yeah. they're avoiding doing the food shop until their knee feels better? So really having an understanding of what it impacts on their life, but also then providing that education of going, it's not simply done to have a knee replacement and you walk out of there and, you know, your knee feels 100% yes, better through there. It's about then that ongoing education of, you know, it's going to take up to 12 to 18 months to feel like, oh, yeah, I forgot I had a knee replacement.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is that other aspect of it about understanding, well, how does it impact you now? But are you aware of what's going to be happening, the so what's post-surgery as well? So they're the conversations we have with people where sometimes they go, yeah, I'm not quite ready for that yet. I'll keep continuing with what we're doing. Another really important component where your guys' role fits in so well is prehab.
Yep.
So we know a lot of the evidence around how beneficial prehab is for post-operative management. So really encouraging people to go, okay, we're considering a knee replacement. It might not be for another 6 months, 12 months, mm-hmm. 3 years. Let's get you as strong as we can. Let's get you as functional as we can so that when that time comes, you have got the most strength and the most range of movement that you have been able to achieve, which is going to have a better outcome post-surgery as well. So that's the other discussion we have going, okay, if we're not ready right now, it doesn't mean you just stop, walk away, keep doing things. Let's see what we can incorporate.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point in sort of educating them, okay, you're going for a major surgery, you're going to have a deficit in your strength and your function. Your strength and function will decline because you need to recover from your surgery. But if you're doing something beforehand, you're basically starting a little bit higher up the mountain where you're not going to fall down as far. I think that's a really great point. I think we've had a few shared clients in the same boat that have had some good outcomes looking at sort of strength and hypertrophy. And I think in terms of those programs, like we don't need to reinvent the wheel. If we've got someone who can consistently get through, I would usually say at least 2 to 3 days of some resistance-based training, that's optimal, which is good. Building on that, I was going to sort of touch on recommendations or sort of how much load we should be doing in terms of knee OA. It's a good question, and I think a lot of it comes down to the individual. But what are you educating your clients on? If you've got someone, let's say with knee OA, who doesn't want to have the replacement, they want to avoid surgery at all costs, what would you say like their minimum effective dose would be?
With regards to how often they should be going to the gym?
How often they should be exercising or what exercise they should be doing?
I would often be encouraging that they're doing strengthening exercises again 2 or 3 times a week and ideally gym. So we know for some people, home with TheraBand or with ankle weights, you can achieve some change, but it's not going to be as good as getting into the gym and actually loading up with
appropriate
ranges. So often we have a look at what the individual can do, but I say aim for 2 or 3 times a week. But it's then not just the strength stuff. It's making sure, okay, are you walking? Are we getting that sort of loading? If need to, are you then doing some reduced loading activities like cycling and swimming as well for overall cardiovascular as well? So, yeah, I don't normally say that they're probably walking 2 or 3 times a week and doing strength-based 2 or 3 times a week.
Excellent. And where do you stand on maybe something like a little bit more of a therapeutic intervention, like some hydrotherapy where we get some compressive relief or potential manual therapy as well? Where do you feel like that sits in the management of knee OA?
Again, it comes down to the individual. So we know when it comes to hydrotherapy, that can have really good benefits, especially with regards to non-weight bearing or reduced weight bearing activities. So if someone really enjoys that and finds it's a really good recovery session for them or a low load session, always happy for that. The same with the compressions. The evidence around that is a little bit up and down, but if an individual finds it's beneficial, I'm not going to say no to that because it's not doing any harm. And that's the same with manual therapy. So some patients will find they just need a little bit of that manual therapy check-in that might help them maintain range of movement. For them, it may, they find it actually helps reduce overall pain that they may be feeling associated with different things around the knee as well. So it really comes to individuals with it. So not against it. Some people really like acupuncture as well.
Yeah, of course.
And if they find that's a great recovery strategy, again, all for it. Yeah. It's not doing any harm.
Yeah, it's always, it's great to try. Like I've had some good success with clients that maybe they come in and they're a little bit gung-ho in their program, and we've got to remember that maybe these clients have never done any strengthening before. And if we're giving them something to do, which I do see happen every day, the knee's going to get sore. It's going to get tired. Those muscles are going to get tight. Mm-hmm. And I've had some good success with things just like a little bit of foam rolling through the quads, which can help improve range of motion, and definitely educating on that balance of more is not more.
much prefer that they do 2 or 3 times a week. Quality
100%
that didn't result in them then struggling to walk for the next 48 hours because they went a bit too hard.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, we can get away with that a little bit at our age, but not something we want to be incorporating in an OA population.
Of course. And
yeah,
I know you mentioned you did a little bit of research into how long a knee replacement actually lasts.
Yes.
Which is good to know, because I feel like a little while ago it was sort of like, oh, you get 10 years out of this and then the client doesn't know what to do. It's like, do I go again? But, yeah, hit us with the info.
So there is, and everyone's going to have access to this research as well. Yep. We'll put up all the references in the notes. So with regards to surgical techniques, we know technology has improved significantly and it's continued to improve. It seems like every day at the moment. So a study that was published in 2019 looked at total knee replacements, and 82% of total knee replacements would last more than 25 years.
Yeah, wow.
So that's a huge change from 30 years ago. When they had a look at another study that was published in 2017, 3.9% of those that had the total knee replacement needed a revision within 10 years, and 10.3% within 20 years. So, again, that's really the statistics when you have a look at the population that is actually having knee replacements. And what they do find out is that age does matter. So the study published in 2017, those that were over 70 years old were 5% less, 5% likely to require a second replacement, whereas those that were 50-year-olds, and this was specifically men, 35% required a second replacement. But they didn't really go into the data of, well, how old were they when they needed that replacement? So was it a 50-year-old that hit 75 and was still going strong and needed to have a knee replacement? So that's, again, something that we consider going. We don't want you to wait until the last minute where you're feeling weaker, quality of life has decreased before you have the knee replacement. But there will be some situations where people will have knee replacements earlier, but we're sort of looking at, well, what's that sweet spot for the individual and their lives.
I think that's really good to know, because a lot of the time people, maybe out of pride or not avoiding surgery, will not want to do this and push it off for as long as you can. And I think the other thing to throw in there is age and other comorbidities. We're going under a general anaesthetic and having to rehabilitate for, like you said, 12 to 18 months before you feel normal is a big jump. And a 5-year gap in doing that can actually be quite big, especially for someone over the age of 70. So.
And I think I'm going to quote my boss, Dr. Quentin Scott, because he's got an absolutely, when we have a think about realistic improvements, he often will tell his patients, it's going to be 3 months before you start to see that you're doing well after your replacement. It's going to be 6 months before you're actually pleased that you had your knee replacement. And it's going to be 9 to 12 months before you've forgotten about it.
Yeah, that's so great. I like that.
It's really important that we're realistic, as much as we, you know, we really push the prehab, we really make sure that we've got as much range of movement, that we've got good quads function, we've got good glute function. Everyone is going to have their own journey through the rehab process. And depends on why they're having their surgeries.
Yeah, of course.
As well, what some of the comorbidities associated with it. So there's no hard and fast rule of how long it goes for, but, you know, with what he's saying through there with the time frames, that's pretty spot on for most people.
Yeah, that's great. I don't think we really touched on it, but just going back from the knee replacement, so going through a conservative treatment approach, what would you sort of educate your clients on as a realistic time frame to see improvements for managing knee arthritis? I know it's extremely variable. It comes down to different degrees and functions and things like that.
Absolutely.
But what would you say someone looking to engage in EP and physio, how long should they stick with that?
So we know from, again, evidence-based perspective that it generally takes 6 to 12 weeks before you're actually noticing some really key functional improvements.
Yep.
I tell people often 3 to 6 months before you really start to notice change. And part of that is sometimes you don't always get the exercise right. We'd like to hope that we get the load right, but it's really up to the individual. Someone will come in and say, yep, I only do this, and this, and you develop a program around that. And then a grandkid comes along, and now they're babysitting the grandkid 4 days a week.
Of course.
Or they have forgotten that they walk to and from the shops, or they love just casually walking around the shops, and they actually clock up, you know, 5,000 steps every day because they enjoy window shopping. Like little variables like that that we try to ask questions about that they don't always think about, or they sort of come back and let you know, oh, actually, I realized I'm really sore after I go to the gym, but that's the day that I meet up at the dog park and we go for a long walk and then have a cup of coffee with friends. So it's about finding that balance with people, but I really do encourage them to persevere. And normally after that stage, that's when people are like, yes, I can notice a difference.
Yeah.
I'm feeling a bit stronger. My function's improved. And that's where coming back to your measurables is really important. So if you had a look at what their squat's like, or you've got measurables on their overall strengthening and you've had a look at what their range of movement's like, you can remeasure that at 6 months and go, do you remember when it was really hard for you to get up off this chair?
Yeah.
You just did that 10 times. How does that feel? Or your knee range of movement, we measured it at this. It's now this. How does that feel? And also linking it functionally. So I'll often try and ask patients, well, what's three things that functionally you're finding really difficult?
Yeah.
And then reassessing that. Okay, how do you find doing this task now? Huh. I actually haven't thought about that. It mustn't be bothering me. Awesome. I want you to go away and try and see what comes to mind with it. So that's also how you can measure how someone's going.
Yeah.
Because they won't think, when you're living with something day to day, you don't see the day to day increases.
Oh, 100%.
Whereas as EPs and physios, we've got the advantage. We might see someone weekly, monthly, whatever they may be coming in for. And you can see these changes and reinforce them. And that keeps coming back to the education as well.
No, I think that's a great point. I like your three things of picking. I think it makes it a little bit more meaningful. And I think sort of crosses over a little bit with some of the questionnaires that we can utilize as well, especially when it comes to like a scaled rating where, like you said, they're living in it. They don't look out back in and see how they're going. But going through some of those questionnaires from when you first see them to when you last see them, okay, look, you've rated walking upstairs an 8 out of 10 difficulty, now you've rated a 2 out of 10 difficulty, and connecting the dots for the clients is really important, because then they look back and go, oh, yeah, I don't think about doing that anymore.
And there's two really key questionnaires that are out with regards to knee osteoarthritis, which is the WOMAC and the CUES, and there's something that you don't get them to do every week or every month. You might do it, okay, initial assessment, let's fill this out.
Yep.
And then maybe 6 to 12 months time, or if they're moving on to something different or whatever their reason may be going, let's have a look at this and just see how much improvement you've had, because that continues to get buy-in as well.
Yep, definitely. And I think it's something that we want to educate clients on, that we want to continue to engage in strength work if they're choosing to manage their knee OA. Like what you said, we want to see 6 to 12 weeks. I'll usually tell my clients 12 weeks. 12 weeks of solid 2 to 3 days of resistance-based training is where we're going to start to see some great improvements. A lot of the time it'll depend on their training age, though, and because as we know, if they haven't done any resistance training before, which can be a lot of the population who are, say, over 60 with knee OA, a lot of your first few weeks is educating them on how to exercise. Mm-hmm. And you may not be getting the best results through that exercise, or you may not be getting, like what you said, the quality of the exercise. So I think looking at our 2 to 3 days of a quality exercise that they can do well and know what they're meant to be doing is ideal.
Lovely. I agree with you on that one.
Yeah. So last question I had for you was, how do you think EPs and physios can work best together? Pretty broad question, but you can narrow it down to a couple of points if you like. How do you think they can work best together to get the best outcomes for clients with knee OA?
So I guess if we sort of put a bit of a scenario, you've got someone that's come to you and going, oh, I think I've got knee OA.
Yep.
I want to start doing strength stuff because I've heard it's really good for me.
Yep.
As an EP within your scope of practice, you know the questions to ask and you may pick up, yep, this individual has features of knee osteoarthritis. Mm-hmm. But from that diagnostic perspective, that's where you might go, okay, I can help develop a program, but what might be really beneficial is let's get you in with a physio just to have a look at a couple of other features, get the diagnosis of knee osteoarthritis and make sure there isn't other any
yeah.
contributing factors, because we know there's some systemic conditions that can present similar to knee osteoarthritis as well. And then from there, we work together. So from an EP perspective, the way that I have a think about it, if I've got a patient coming in with knee OA, we've had a look at ankle, knee, hip, contributing factors, glute function, quad function, and there's someone that's really keen to go to a gym, I'll go, let's actually get you started with an EP.
Yep.
Because the intention is you're with someone that has the skill set to be able to prescribe you a program that you can do in the gym that can supervise you in the gym, get the correct load, and then teach you how to be able to do that either continually coming in classes or back at your own gym at your home location, whether it be the local gym or you've got a setup at home.
Yep.
Going from there. And then it sort of works both ways. I may not always see that patient again, but if you're then seeing someone and you're noticing decline, they're reporting that they're getting more pain or that it's starting to limit them a little bit more, that's when the discussion might go, let's just double check that there isn't anything else that's going on, and it might be time that we're having a look at, well, what else can we actually do
moving forward?
So that's sort of how I see working together. Some of the things are blended from an exercise prescription, but that's where we go, well, what are some exercises that are at home that are targeting specific movement impairments that we might have identified that can be a daily exercise compared to what's a targeted strengthening program as well.
Yeah, excellent. I think that's a great answer, and that sort of fits in to my beliefs at the moment is where we do have something. And I think as EPs, we don't want to be too blasé and just say, oh, I've probably knee OA, because like what we spoke about earlier today, there's a big criteria. Like there's 6 main things and we don't, that's not necessarily what we learn and what we do. So I definitely urge, if we're not certain or if we don't know, it's great to get assessed anyway, because a lot of discomfort that they can be getting can also be associated with some ligament damage and things like that. And like what you said, inflammation and flare-ups. But similar along your lines, like once we get a little bit of a roll on and that client's engaging in some regular programs, having the physio to touch base regularly, if no issues, but definitely referring back if we're seeing no improvements, if we're seeing changes in pain levels is great, because like what you've spoken about today, Caitlin, you've got a great understanding of the holistic approach and just those little things that we might not pick up on.
So. Well, we can even talk about our mutual patient who is having their surgery this week.
Oh, is it this week?
It's all right. This week.
Thanks today.
Where someone that I could go 3 months without seeing,
yep.
but then came back in for appointment going, okay, surgery is this date. I want to know what I need to be doing immediately post-op,
yep.
what I can and can't do, what some suggestions from management, pain relief going forwards from there. So they were still doing the program and coming to see you pretty
yep.
regularly.
Yeah.
But also then knowing, okay, this is where I need to just get some more specific information from there too.
Yeah, definitely.
So be excited to see their outcome
post-op. Yeah, no, I think it is today.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming in today, Caitlin. Really appreciate you sharing your knowledge. And I hope the listeners learned something new and took something out of today. I certainly did. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers. All right.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. So remember to share, like, or follow to keep updated with all our podcasts and educational resources.